Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, welcome back. Today we're going to start part two, getting into the meat of our story. Episode one, which is the larger scene episode that we are dealing with, is the first time we encounter Yaakov and Esav. We already covered their birth. We covered the miraculous nature of their birth after 20 years of barrenness, how Rivka finally conceives. She is troubled. She's told through prophecy that she's carrying twins and they're going to be different. They're going to separate. A mite will pass from one to the other. And we are told a little bit about their birth, one being Red, and Harry, named by everybody Esav, because he was Asu, he was made, he was fully developed and done when he came out, as opposed to his brother Yaakov, who only thing we're told about was that he was physically holding on to the heel of his older brother. And Yaakov, he singularly names him Esav, because he and he alone sees the significance in that, both as Rashi said, that before the elder will finish his reign, the younger will come on the heel of it and take it from him. Or as we saw the last time we got together, Ezra Hirsch understood it, the word heel, as it means something sneaky at the end, unexpected. Just when Esav thought he was going to have full control and world dominion, right then and there, at the very end, in the last moment, Yaakov is going to come and take it from him. And certainly it is of note, as we're watching world history unfold before us, the world powers, the Western world powers, certainly our host country of the United States of America, is an Esav country, descended from Edom of Rome. Just when you think it will have world dominion, just wait. Just you wait. Last moment, Yaakov is going to come and take it from him. May we all merit to see that soon. And let's go home. Let's go home. Okay, sorry, I just had to throw that in there. Yeah, someone was just telling me that the bumper sticker, who was it over a while, mm-hmm. that the bumper sticker of the Jew should be, I don't belong here. Those are my own words. I'm the ger. I'm the toshav. I'm the foreigner. I don't, it's not my place. It's not my place.
So why do we need a bumper sticker? As long as we think it's inside ourselves.
Go home, yeah. Well, we should just leave. Well, no, the reason why we need a bumper sticker is that it really should be where we as a culture feel that way. In other words, if Jewish history has taught us anything, it's as soon as we begin to think that we belong, that's really the end of our stay in that particular place. And so we should need to be part of our culture, spoken about regularly. This is not where we belong. We are not where we belong. Okay, but meanwhile we're here, so let's learn. Okay, so let's start part two. So again, even though there are three distinct episodes in the Torah where the Torah introduces the characters of Yaakov and Esav, in our particular, the first episode, there are clearly two separate stories within the first episode, because many years go by between the first, in which we're told about their birth, and then the episode in which they grow up, and we're going to see the sale of this birthright, this elusive sale, this understanding of what that means. But let us start with verse 27, if you have your plain text sheets in front of you. I see that you all do. Let's just read one or two verses, raise all the questions again, and then we'll start to see what the commentators have to say. Vayigdalu anelrim, the lads grew up. Vayihi Esav ish yodea tzayid ish sadeh. Esav was a man who understood hunting. A yodea tzayid. He knew, he understood hunting. Ish sadeh, a man of the field. V'Yaakov ish tam yoshev ohalim. And Yaakov was a wholesome man, tam from the word simple, wholesome, one who dwelled, abided in tents. That was the first pasuk. Any questions, comments that we had? Anyone remember what we had from this pasuk?
Very hard to explain tam.
Tam is a very tricky word, because as our Pesach Seder, if you recall, we discussed the word tam in our Pesach Seder is a very simple son. Someone who you explain things on a very simplistic level, which would not really seem to describe what we're trying to get at with Yaakov, but we do use that same word of tam to mean wholesome, and we will see, Rashi at least, and will explain to us why we have a word which means something, a simpleness, in description here of Yaakov. Oh, halim is singular or plural where Yaakov would dwell?
Yeah, people think that simple means retarded.
Or it has a negative connotation to it.
Yeah, very much so.
Ohalim is plural.
He dwelled in tents.
Right.
How many tents do you think he dwelled in? Or would I visualize it as he's dwelled in the Beis HaMedrash? So then you could have said he was a Yoshev Ohel. He dwelled in the tent. He was in a singular tent, and he stayed there all day, and he sat and studied. So somehow there are more than one tent in which he's dwelling. We'll talk about that as well. How about Esav? How would you describe Esav in this pasuk?
Understood hunting.
Great. Two ways that we describe him. He's a man who understood hunting.
Outdoors.
And then we call him an Ish Sadeh. So that there are two phrases used to describe Esav. One, that he knows to hunt, understands the craft of hunting, and two, that he is an Ish Sadeh, a man of the field. And when does all of this happen that we learn about Yaakov and Esav?
When he comes in with they grew up.
As they grow up.
Yeah.
And so this becomes clear to us after they have grown up. Vayigdalu anarim, they grow up, and then we discover Esav becomes this man who knows hunting, a man of the field, and Yaakov is a Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim. Let's do one more pasuk to get the full flavor of this issue over here, and then we'll get to the commentators. Vayehav Yitzchak es Esav kitzayid b'fiv. Yitzchak loved Esav because game was in his mouth. That's the literal translation. Ki tzayid b'fiv. Because game, tzayid, was in his mouth. V'rivka oheves as Yaakov. And Rivka, she loved Yaakov. And we mentioned some glaring questions that we would have on this pasuk.
Yeah, such difference. I mean,
quantify that.
Meaning that Esav loved things, hunting, and Rivka loved, and Yaakov loved a woman.
Yitzchak, the father, loved Esav because of a thing. The Torah tells us, why does Yitzchak love his son Esav? Because game was in his mouth. Which, A, is interesting, we're told the reason why he loved him, and B, it's an interesting reason. Talking about Yitzchak Avinu, and why does he love his son Esav? Because he's got fresh meat?
Yeah. Well, he bought him.
There's excitement.
He
talks a lot.
Okay, now we're going to see, Rashi's going to comment on what you're commenting, that there's another way to read the word Tzayid B'fiv, not that there was game in his mouth.
When he asked his son, he asked him to prepare a meal.
Correct.
From something new.
Could it be that Yitzhak was so much in the tents, he loved the idea that somebody was out there in the other world of the material world?
Maybe.
And also the field. Does that kind of mean agriculture?
Okay, we're going to talk about that. Someone else was defined as a man who did agriculture, but we didn't use the word Ish Sadeh, we used a different word.
I was wondering if it's a different word.
Yeah, it was. Anyone remember? We described it both by Noach and by Cain. Cain, the first man born. And remember the phrase we use there? He was an Ish Adama, man of the earth. Ish Sadeh is a different phrase. There's being a man of the earth, which is used in reference to agriculture, and there's an Ish Sadeh, man of the field, which is a different connotation, which fits much more with being a hunter. Hunting is using the earth in a very different way than if you're using it agriculturally. So Noach and Cain have that phrase of being an Ish Adama, and Esav here is defined as an Ish Sadeh, man of the field, not a man of the earth.
What is it like comparing farming to office work? Or?
They're different. Farming is different than hunting, which is certainly different than sitting in the Beis Medrash. That's right.
Is he hunting Lashon Hara with his mouth? Is he hunting for bad news, good news, everybody's news? Is that another way to be a hunter here?
Oh, okay. So there are many different ways of reading Tzayid B'Fiv. The simplest meaning is that Yitzchak loved Esav because Tzayid, a noun, game, food, was in his mouth, meaning Yitzchak's mouth. Like because food was always in his mouth, he loved him.
Uh-huh.
The other way of reading it is that the word Tzayid is a verb. He loved him because he hunted with his mouth. Meaning that he is now referring to Esav, that Esav hunted with his mouth.
Hunted his father.
Now, we could then say, what did he hunt? Did he hunt for Lashon Hara? That's what we'll get to, but Rashi's all different, but those are the two ways of reading is the word Tzayid, a verb or a noun. Is it referring to Yitzchak loving Esav because game was in his own mouth, or because he loved Esau because Esau hunted him with his mouth.
Thing with this verse that always strikes me as strange is I would think that a parent would love both children.
Mm-hmm. And here we have each parent is only being described as loving one or the other.
Yeah, but they loved them for different reasons because they were so different.
Okay,
your son was different.
But it is of note that the pasuk doesn't say that that Yitzchak also loved Esav and Rivka. It's each parent is attributed a child. There's an interesting way of describing things. Now, again, as we go through this, we're about to start. When we get to Rivka, the mother knows the prophecy. She knows the younger will eventually be served by the elder. She knows there are going to be two regimes. She knows that might is going to transfer from one to the other. And now she looks at him. She sees one son out there running with his bow and arrow, and the other son sitting and studying. She knows that. Yitzchak, we don't know whether or not he's also aware of that or not. But we'll get to all that. Let's get started.
Can I one more comment? One moment. It's ironic. If he's a hunter with his mouth as the verb, that's what he gives up. When he gives up all of his birthright for what hunted in his mouth, he gave up the porridge or whatever else it was, right? Is that a prophetic sort of statement?
Could be. Let's take a look at... You know what? I didn't want to do Rashi first because Rashi gets into the Medrash. I actually wanted to start with Ramban. You can pull out your blue sheet first. Okay, Ramban is on page 9 in your blue sheets. We're going to see where I am. Verse 28, Kitzayid Befiv. This is now the second verse. And Yitzchak loved Esav because game was in his mouth. Ramban is going to take us through Pshat, understanding this phrase, his interpretation, and then we'll see Rashi and his more Midrashic interpretation. Says the Ramban, the connection between Yitzchak's eating game and his love for Esav, meaning, why does Yitzchak love his son simply because game is in his mouth? Says the Ramban, their commentators, quoting from, you see in the bottom, from the Ibn Ezra, from Adak, from many of the commentators, say that this means that Esav placed game into the mouth of Isaac, or he brought it to his mouth, meaning game was in his mouth, and this is the way that we would naturally read it. He had placed, even though there's a missing verb, not that he didn't say he placed game in his mouth, but that means that Esav
provided
the game to his mouth, and the simple action of placed or brought is absent, but not to be concerned with that phrase. Alternatively, going down, that's a simple meaning. Alternatively, says the Ramban on the bottom, it is possible to interpret it as Yitzchak loved Esav because there was always game in Yitzchak's mouth, meaning all day long he desired to eat game, so it was always in his mouth and he would not eat anything else. Kitzayid b'siv, it doesn't say he placed it, it just says game was in his mouth, meaning always. Yitzchak had this desire for meat. Yes, Esav was always providing it. And so Yitzchak loves Esav because he's constantly being fed. He never eats anything other than fresh meat, breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Not a vegetarian.
Clearly not. Not a vegetarian. Says Ramban, if you flip over to page 10, he does it like this. Sound this explanation, in my view, that this is a figure of speech. Meaning, the commentators are working through the text. Kitzayid b'siv is a tough phrase. Now, the reason why I'm stressing this now is because we're going to get to Rashi and we see the Midrashic interpretation. Very often, the way that the Torah works, as we've seen many times, is that where do the Medrash come from? Where are the sages picking up on the story beneath the story? So they're picking up because the phrase of the Torah is missing something. There's a hint in the way the Torah tells the story. And here we have a very strange phrase. Yitzchak loves Esav, Kitzayid b'siv. Now, Tzayid b'siv means game in his mouth. Literally, game in his mouth. So the commentators on the Pshat level, similar, read the words, what does it mean, game in his mouth? So one says, that just means there's a missing verb in the pasuk, and they'll bring you other examples where there are missing verbs. Don't be so bothered by that. Or it means, no, game in his mouth, always. It's coming to say how common it was. Ramban says, don't be bothered by any of this. Let me explain to you what the simple meaning is. But note that the phrase is odd. It should have said he hazy tied the fifth. He brought game to his mouth. He placed game in his mouth. But it says about it's a figure of speech, meaning Esav was game in his father's mouth, meaning it refers to the person by his conduct due to its constancy. Meaning to say, whenever Yitzchak wanted something, he can count on Esav to be able to provide it. he supports it with the medrash at the end there. And so they said in Bereishis Rabbah, if Esau found a good piece of meat, he would bring it to Yitzchak's mouth. If he found a good cup of wine, he would bring it to Yitzchak's mouth. So what is the phrase, according to Ramban, what does it mean that Yitzchak loved Esau ki tzayid b'fiv, because game was in his mouth? Doesn't mean, says Ramban, that he loved meat so much that he always had meat. It means that his son Esau was always looking to provide and take care of him. So that whenever he found something good, he would run and bring it to his father and said, I just found the choicest piece of meat. I want you to have it, Abba. Taste this wine. It's amazing. So that struggling with the again, we're going to see in Rashi, the Midrashic interpretation, but the strange verbiage or usage of the words, ki tzayid b'fiv, Yitzchak loved Esau because game in his mouth, is a figure of speech, the Ramban says. He loved him because Esau was always looking to put game in his mouth. He was looking to find something good to bring to him. Mm-hmm. And therefore you say, no, wasn't that Yitzchak had a meat craving? It's that he saw in his son the constant desire to take care of him. We notice those things. This person in the office, this boss, this coworker, this employee that I have, is always looking when something good, they want to share it with me. We notice those things. So Yitzchak noticed that Esav always was looking to put the choicest piece of meat, the choicest cup of wine, into his hands to say, this is what I brought him. This is what I brought for you.
An ulterior motive? Is there an interior?
We're talking on the simple level of the meaning. We'll see, yes. But why did Yitzchak love Esav? Because he saw that Esav was looking to win his favor and was constantly looking to do something for him.
But couldn't we just count if he had a desire to give? He's part of the Jewish soul.
I mean, yes,
since God gives,
I agree. It doesn't have to be that he wanted to win his favor.
Yeah.
It could be that he was always providing.
All what we have is that, yes, he was always looking to provide for his father. Anything more than that, we can suggest things. But what the Ramban is saying, the meaning of the pasuk, ki tzayid b'fiv, Esav was always looking to put a piece of game, a choice piece of meat, of drink, in his father's hands. Okay. Let's take a look around. Rashi's got a lot of midrashic interpretations. I wanted to start with a simple meaning, and now we'll get to Rashi. Now, what we're going to see in Rashi is a theme which comes across often in the Chumash, that when the Torah tells us that a certain character is not a favorable character, we read many phrases in a negative light in interpretation, because we see the Torah views this character negatively. So we'll see the phrases that we have in that negative light. Rashi starts on page 278. Okay, everybody got me on page 278? Here we go. He's going back a verse to the first verse that we read together. The lads grew up. Esau became a man who knows hunting, a man of the field. Says Rashi, the lads grew up and Esau became. All the while that they were small, they were not distinguishable in their deeds. Meaning, ein adam medakdek b'hem. Nobody could discern in them tivam what their nature was. Vayigdalu. Only when they grew up did we see, look, this one is a man of the field and this one is a man who sits in the tent. Until they grew up, you would look at the children and you would not notice any difference. Once they turned 13 years old, they became a gadol. Rashi's reading the word vayigdalu. We could read that literally or more conceptually. They grew up or they turned 13. They became a gadol. Rashi's reading it as a literal. They turned 13. They became a gadol. They became an adult in Jewish law and halacha. And now look what happens. Esav became a man of the field. Yaakov became one who dwelled in the tents. Zeh perish the bote midrashos. This one set out for the houses of Torah study. And the other one set out for idolatry. But it only... Now again, right, the Torah says, what did he set out for? Just becoming a man of the field. But Rashi is again pointing out, we're going to see a steady stream of midrashic negative interpretations of Esav. And it starts, Vayigdalu, then we're going to get back to this when we see Refersh in a moment, that this happens when they turn 13. But until then, Rashi says explicitly, if you were to look at the boys, and they're 10, and they're 11, and they're in school, they're on the basketball team together, and you would say, ah, cute boys. You would have no inkling that they were headed in different directions. Yeah.
Yet when they were born, they were distinguishable right away.
They were distinguishable. Okay, remember we saw a couple of ideas on this. They were distinguishable in physical characteristics in the sense that Esav was hairier and redder. But if you remember when Rav Hirsch read that, he said, but that was only in terms of he was more further along in his development. They looked the same. They had the same look. He just had that healthier reddish hue and a hairy body because he was healthier. But twins-wise, as far as twins go, they look the same. And Rashi here is not talking about their physical characteristics as much as he's talking about their behaviors. And sometimes we know twins. Sometimes you see twins. I know twins. They're 8 now. They're 9 now. Now, I'm not saying one's evil and one's a righteous individual, but that they're the same, I could tell. These kids are going to do different things in life. Look at them. There's no way they're going to end up doing the same thing. Again, not saying bad, good. They're different. So Rashi here is stating explicitly, but these two boys, before they hit 13, you wouldn't see a difference in their behavior. They look the same. What's going to be with them? I don't know, they're twins. We'll see what happens with them. Now, as Lucy pointed out, the Torah says that Esav goes and becomes a man of the field, a hunter. And Rashi says this one separated to the houses of study, which is what the Pasuk says. And this one separated to idolatry. And here you already see Rashi and the sages throwing in not just becoming a man of the field in the sense of being a hunter, but it being a very negative connotation of leaving the house of study, leaving a life of Torah and becoming one of idolatry. So that the field represents more than just not being a studier, but it means leaving the concept of what the Beis Medrash represents, which I'm agreeing with you is more than what the Pasuk says. And we're going to add that to our, when we talk about like what happens with these kids, we see in that statement, that one word from the sages, already the idea that leaving the house of study, it doesn't have to be that way. Leaving the house of study can mean going out to work to support the house of study. Mm-hmm. But in Asa's case, it doesn't mean that, and the sages already see that in the beginning. We'll get back to that concept many times. Not being in the house of study doesn't mean not being within the fold of the Jewish people, within the fold of observant religious Judaism. It just means that there are those who actually study and there are those who do other things. The sages see in Asa's leaving the house of study a leaving of, not because I don't want to study, but a leaving of I don't want anything to do with this. So what we're gonna talk a lot about is leaving the house of study and what it represents. In other words, leaving the house of study to work for the house of study, or to, you know, there are two reasons why you leave. You leave because I need to do something else, or you leave, I don't want this. Two ways of leaving something. And the sages see in Asa's leaving to the house of idolatry. Keep on going. Who knows the side? Who knows trapping? Who knows hunting? Here Rashi goes right away into the Midrashic. Now, says Rashi, he knew to latsud vilaremos, to ensnare and deceive his father with his mouth. Playing off of the phrase we're going to see of Yodei Tzayid, he knows how to hunt with his mouth, he knew how to ensnare and deceive his father. He would ask him, Ava, heich ma'asr nesamelach yasateven, how do we tithe salt and straw? Now, salt and straw are two products which do not require tithing. There is no miser or truma. If a farmer in Eretz Yisrael grows corn, he grows wheat, he grows whatever product he grows, so you have to tithe it. You take off first a portion to the Kohen, then you take off a portion to the Levi. Straw and salt are not items which need to be tithed. Straw, which is a byproduct of wheat or other grain products. Salt, which is a byproduct of evaporated ocean water or other bodies of water that are salt content. If you are a, I don't know what you would call it, a salt harvester or producer or whatever, that's what you do, you don't tithe that. There's no halacha, no requirement. So I wouldn't say it's putting effort into, but it would have to be something which was produced by the ground. Whether or not you put effort, you put effort, but in other words, but something which is either a byproduct, straw which is a byproduct. We'll see a little bit, we'll talk about it in a few moments, why the sages picked up that this is what Esav was asking about. For right now, it doesn't require tithing. Esav would ask his father, Abba Heich Ma'asrin, how do you do it? Kasover of, if his father would be under the impression that Esav was meticulous about the fulfillment of the commandments. Look at it, what a medakdek b'mitzvos, how particular he is, that he's asking how to tithe these products. And Esav therefore came to the conclusion, what a tzaddik my son is. And Tzayid Befif, he hunted him with his mouth. He knew the craft of being a deceiver. and he knew what to ask to get his father to believe that he was indeed a righteous individual. And that's what his father thought. Now the Maral, I'll share with you, points out, why these two products? Why is Esav asking specifically about these? What's the halakha? Why don't you need to take off my certain facts from these questions? And he starts with the question, Esav did not ask the question of, do you need to? He didn't ask, Abba, should I take off my sir? He asked the question of, how? Which means he was already presupposing that you need to.
Or he already knew that you didn't have to, that he was deceiving his father.
Okay, but the question, what I mean to say is that the question presupposes that his understanding was that you do, and he was asking, but how do you do it? Says the Maral, well, why don't you need to take off in these two instances? The Maral says as follows. Straw you don't take off, Iser, because it's a byproduct. What it does is it protects the fruit, the grain, while it's growing. And then when it's fully grown, as you go through the entire process of taking a stalk of wheat and pulling out the kernel that you need and discarding everything else, so that's discarded byproduct. It was there as a protection, but it's not the actual product itself. It's a byproduct. Salt isn't an actual product itself. It gives taste to a product. And they're on opposite ends of the spectrum. Salt, which has so much taste that you can't eat it. It's so full of flavor, so to speak, that you can't eat it alone. It's only added to something to provide flavor, but you would never eat a chunk of salt. You shouldn't, at least, right? But you would add it to all your food. Now, food without salt is tasteless, but it's not a food itself. It's something added to food. Straw, while it protects the fruits, the grain, the product, the pre, but it itself has no taste. So you go from no taste to too much taste, neither one of which require to be tied, because neither one itself is something. Both of these things are created for something else, either to protect or to give flavor.
Or preserve.
Or preserve, excellent. Esav, in his conniving ways, says, listen, Abba, sof kol sof, at the end of the day, both of these products were created by God to aid us, either to give us taste or to protect our produce as it's growing. How can it be that we would take something which has such value and not tithe it? So that he went to something which does not require tithing and asked how. We're clearly not using the regular methods because it's not required, but how should we take off tithes? How should we take from these products which are of such benefit to us, and give it back, so to speak, to Hashem in the form of gifts to others, because they're so valuable to us. It must be that we take everything that we have and return it to Hashem. So that the question wasn't just a question of he's a medaktik, the mitzvahs, he's particular in the observance of mitzvahs, and Yitzchak says he's a tzaddik. It was the way in which he was a medaktik. Mm-hmm. He asked specifically about things that he's busy with his hands. He's a man in the field. So he's got his straw or his saw. He's out there working. And he's got these products. I want to be able to somehow show that I got these things and I want to give them back. So how do I do it, Abba? I know it's not the regular methods, but how should we be able to show all of this comes from you? We want to be able to give it back. And his father says that he would take the two extremes, that which has no taste, that which has too much taste, but both serve a purpose of protecting the food while it's growing, or providing flavor. And my son Esav says, how should we do it? How should we give gifts back to Hashem from them? So Yitzchak says, my boychik, this is my little tzaddik, this is my righteous individual. And through that, Esav was able to ensnare and deceive his father. Ish Sadeh was a man in the field, continues Rashi. This is to be understood as it sounds. He was a man who was idle and would catch with his bow beasts and birds. He would go, he would be hanging out in the field. Now, the commentators on Rashi point out that Rashi is coming from the fact that it doesn't say, the Maral says, it doesn't say Ish Adama. That would mean that he worked the field. He was a man of the earth. The Torah calls him an ish sadeh. He was just a man who hung out in the fields. Therefore, it must be that he was just going out there to hang out, and he would take his bow and he would catch whatever it was that he could while he was there. Now, what about Yaakov? Yaakov is called an ish tam. Says Rashi, now he said there's almost that simplistic connotation to that word. So Rashi says, yeah, it was simplistic. Wholesome, meaning he was not an expert in all of these things which we just mentioned, that Esav was an expert. As in his heart, so was in his mouth. That's tamimus. Tamimus, being tamima, being wholesome, is that which comes out of your mouth is that which is in your heart. You're not deceiving or misleading or providing a false veneer with your words, something separate than that which is really going on inside. And one who is not sharp in deceiving is called wholesome, is tam. So it is a simplistic language in contrast to knowing how to deceive. Someone who is tam, who is simple.
In his mouth, it's not necessarily food, but it could be words.
His words were simple, meaning simple in the sense of accurately describing that which is going on inside. And I tell my children all the time, despite the fact that they don't ever listen to me, when I say this, there's a very well-practiced custom amongst children, which is they get it from their adults, because no one ever stops doing it, of, we'll call it the practical joke with one's mouth, of saying something which you don't mean, which is not true. They, I got you, you believe me? I told you to look over there and there was nothing there, or I said this, and it was, and I always say to them, if you say something, it should be that the people listening to you believe what you're saying. Not because they're gullible, because you are a person who speaks truth. So that when you say something, everybody around you should say, of course. Not that you then say, I got you, you believe me, it wasn't really true. All that you're doing is you're establishing yourself into a person who is not tam, who is not tamima, who is not tamimus, whose words don't mean what they say. And you don't want to establish yourself as a person who, when you say something, everybody has to say to themselves, filter it through. I don't know, do they mean it? That's not a positive trait. I want everybody in this house to be gullible all the time, because it should be that the person who's speaking always is saying the truth. And the Torah has a word for that. That's tam. Simple. What's going on inside is what comes out outside. So when you say something, I know that that's what you're thinking. And I don't have to be worried that you're deceiving me, it's a joke, I have to pay attention. That's not a positive trait in somebody, that when someone else hears your words, they don't know if they should believe you or not.
It makes me think of a Yiddish and tam.
Right.
You know?
That's a different word.
Yeah.
That's tam from flavor.
Yeah.
That's a different kind of, but it also should be that way. So Yaakov is an ishtam. What's inside is out there. Esav is a deceiver. You don't know what you're getting. He's asking questions that lead one to believe and to think that he's really like this. So it's really not true. He's just using his words to deceive. And using words to deceive is very powerful. Just today, I just found out last night about that whole thing in England with the hospital I missed. But that practical joke that was told, a couple of radio hosts in Australia called up the hospital where Kate was recovering from.
Pretending to be the queen
and to get information, and it went all over the internet, and the poor nurse was so humiliated that she committed suicide 3 days later. So, you know, because you get a phone call, so like, it should be that. Now again, you have to live life, and you have to know that there are people out there who are thieves, who are crooks, who are not telling the truth. But what would life be like if everybody like spoke the truth? Just like, how different would society function if we weren't afraid of being duped?
They call it a sense of humor. Huh?
Right? So a sense of humor, you can be funny without having to be at somebody else's expense, without having to, you know, put somebody else down or show how foolish they are. It's a sad statement. But in any case, so that's Esav was Tzai B'Siv versus Yaakov Ishtam. Okay, let's take a look at a fascinating piece from Rav Hirsch. This is really going to, and again, we'll put a spin on this entire episode. It begins on
425.
425, thank you. 425. Okay, top of page 425. This is again. This is Rav Hirsch. I want to stress again, I said this I believe once or twice before, but I want to stress again, particularly with this piece, because it's such a fascinating piece. Rashi and the Ramban both were, for those of you who are going through our Svarim classes, you're familiar with the period known as the Rishonim, the early commentators. They lived fairly soon after the sealing of the Gemara. The Gemara was sealed in the year 500. It was then edited and put in the final position that we have it over the next several hundred years. And Rashi was born in the year 1065, so he's 1040 to 1105. So he was born about 500 years after the Gemara was sealed, but only about 100 to 200 years after the final editing process was completed. And he's one of the first primary commentators on the Talmud. And together with that, he wrote his massive commentary on Chumash. The Ramban lived 200 years after him. These are, in the period of Rishonim, principal commentators on the Chumash. The Rav Hirsch is in a totally different caliber. He's living in the year 1800s, 600 years later. On the pedestals that we create for the commentaries, Rashi and the Ramban are on one, and Rav Hirsch is on another one. And I don't need to take anything away from him. He's far above where I am, but he's nowhere near where Rashi and the Ramban are. So that when the Rashi and the Ramban make a comment, it's from the period of the Rishonim. It has a certain weight as to the commentary, the value of the commentary. Rav Hirsch is just much more recent. So we are studying it. I think his work is very valuable, and it's tremendous insights, and has a tremendous amount to learn to teach us. But just because we're doing it like Rashi and Ramban, Rav Hirsch, I want to just stress every once in a while that they weren't on the same plane as they wrote their commentary. And just because Rav Hirsch writes something doesn't mean necessarily the Rashi and Ramban would have agreed to it. And that because he's going to say something that's, I'm giving this whole introduction particularly here because of what we're about to see. I just want to, he was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, and it's worth reading his words. But I give that introduction as we get started. Says Rav Hirsch in verse 27, our sages never objected to draw attention to the small and great mistakes and weaknesses in the history of our great forefathers. First, we've seen this a couple of other times. And he's not saying it's me. Chazal, the sages, point out the mistakes that the Avos make. Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, Sarah. When there's a mistake that's made, they point it out. The Ramban, who I just made this whole big thing about, that he's on a different plane. The Ramban writes, when Sarah mistreated Hagar, after Hagar became pregnant and kicks her out of the house, the Ramban says, that was a mistake. And that's why we're still suffering at the hands of the Arabs until today, says the Ramban. When Avraham leaves the land of Israel to go down to Mitzrayim and put Sarah in a box to hide her from that was a mistake. He shouldn't have done so. So says Rav Hirsch, standing on the shoulders of the giants, our sages have not been afraid of pointing things out that were done incorrectly, and thereby make them just the more instructive for us. There's a reason for that. The reason why the sages, Chazal, the earlier commentators point them out is because the point of the Torah is to be a Torah, Horah, is to teach, to instruct. To give us a book, to give us the word of Hashem and say, you're a human being, this is where you are now, this is where I want you to be, and this is how you're going to get there. Through the mitzvahs, through the stories of the Bereishis. So therefore we're pointed out when things were done incorrectly. Here too on Vayigdalu, on the words that they grew up, they make a remark which is indeed a signpost for all of us. Now what I want to point out is that we read a Rashi which he's going to comment on. The Rashi that we read was from the sages, Vayigdalu, they grew up. Until they were 13, you didn't know the difference. They looked the same. They behaved the same. And when they turned 13, all of a sudden, things changed. Now we read that, very nice. Rav Hirsch is going to read, why are they telling us that? What difference does it make? Why does the Torah put the word Vayigdalu in there to hint at us that it happened when they were 13, and that until then you didn't know the difference? Why is it relevant for us to know that? Let's say they would have gone their different paths from the time they were 3. Would it have mattered? So first, they're saying this because in that remark is a scathing rebuke of Yitzchak and of Rivka. This is Rav Hirsch interpretation. In other words, we just read the Rashi. Rav Hirsch understands that comment that Rashi makes, which is based on the sages, is intended to be one of the examples where the sages point out mistakes made by our forefathers, by parents, in this case Yitzchak and Rivka. Let's see how he understands that. They point out that the striking contrast in the grandchildren of Abraham is being poetic. Like, can you imagine the grandchildren of Abraham as an idolater? May have been due, not so much to a difference in their temperaments as to mistakes in the way they were brought up. Says Rav Hirsch as follows. As long as they were little, no attention was paid to the slumbering differences in their nature. Both had exactly the same teaching and educational treatment. And the great law of education of Chanoch Lenar al Pidarko, bring up each child in accordance with its own way, was forgotten. If you looked at them and you said they were the same, they were treated the same, they were given the same education, but the slumbering differences were there. You're going to have a Yaakov and an Esav. It just wasn't there if you looked superficially. If you looked at them, you would see the same types of children. But the Torah is hinting at, but look what happened to them. Where did that come from? Somebody needed to be paying attention and see, these are very different children and they need very different methods of education. That each child must be treated differently with an eye to the slumbering tendencies of his nature, and then out of them to be educated to develop his special characteristics for the one pure human and Jewish life. The great, you must always have an eye on your children and see what are the differences amongst them so that I can raise each one in his way. The great Jewish task in life is basically simple, one and the same for all. He's so poetic. This is one of my favorite lines out of all the readings that we've done. The basic task, simple for all of us. It's one and the same for all. What's that? Be a good person. Keep the mitzvahs of the Torah. That's it. It's simple. However, says Rav Hirsch, but its realization is as complicated and varied as human natures and tendencies are varied, and the manifold varieties of life that result from them. The basic task is the same. We all share it. It's simple. Fulfill your potential. Be a great Jew, a great human being. Follow the necessities of the Torah. Got it? It's great. Done. Simple. But the realization of that, of each person fulfilling their potential, becoming the greatness that's latent within them, is as varied as the personalities of each person.
I agree with that.
Right? Isn't that a beautiful way of describing that? Our goal is the same for everybody. Very straightforward. How to fulfill that? How to achieve that? 1.5 million differences for 1.5 million different people.
That was my greatest challenge with my two boys, was because they were so different.
So that actually, and as great a challenge as it is, that's, you've won half the battle because you see how different they are. Mm-hmm. The real challenge is when
they need a different,
right? When it's not as obvious that they need different things. It's much easier to give different things to children when it's obvious that they need them. But when it's just a little bit more nuanced and it's easier to sort of just lump them together and do the same thing for both, then it becomes a little bit more challenging. Says Rav Hirsch, when Yaakov Avinu, when our father Jacob visualized the tribes of our nation and his sons standing around his deathbed, meaning he's now referring to the end of the Sefer Bereishis. Yaakov is on his deathbed, he has his 12 sons around him, and he gives each one their mission and their blessing for the particular son. What he saw, not only future priests and teachers, he saw around him the tribes of Levi. He saw the tribes of royalty. He saw merchants. He saw farmers. He saw soldiers. Before his mental eye, he saw the nation in all of its most manifold characteristics and diverse paths of life. 12 sons standing before him, 12 sons representing such varied elements of the Jewish people, merchants, farmers, scholars, teachers, priests, kings. And he blessed all of them, ish kibirchaso beirach osam, each one according to his bracha. Each one recognizing this is this one's strength, that one is this one's strength. Each according to his specialty, with and in his different path of life did he bless him. I've mentioned many times, in many different contexts, an army is comprised of many different units. There's an army, there's an air force, there's a navy, there's a tank corps, there's intelligence, there are foot soldiers. Who's better? Who's right? Ridiculous question. There's no better, right? There's no better, there's no right. A well-functioning army, military unit, has all the different components, and they really should function together beautifully. And when they do, you have a powerful force. But there's no right or wrong, there's just different. So people, the Jewish people, have 12 tribes. 12 different tribes, 12 different, as we first said. You have merchants, you have soldiers, you have priests, you have kings, you have teachers and scholars, farmers. The only problem is when any one group would say, you all need to be like me. Then it doesn't work. I have it right, and therefore what you're doing is wrong. It's so tricky in Jewish life because there are actually segments which are not within a Torah lifestyle. They're not accepting Torah as either being divine or binding, and then we're required to say, no, that's wrong. That's wrong. It is not acceptable. It's not correct. And discern that my attitude for that is to say wrong, yet to discern within Torah, it's okay that I do it this way and you do it that way, as long as you're within the realm of Torah observance. Torah, there are 12 sons, they did different things. And it's been hard for us historically as a people to be able to discern when it is to say, that's not right. And it's unacceptable. And when to say, okay, I do it like this, and you do it like that, but everyone's within the realm of halacha. So if you're within the realm of halacha, you know, I'm in the realm of halacha.
Based on people's understanding, you know, because it seems different, you know.
Well, that's why you've always struggled with this, because what gets blurred is all of a sudden, then it gets crossed into, well, I think what you're doing is not according to halacha. In other words, this has always been a very tricky thing. In other words, each group would say, okay, let's say, all right, there are four movements that they're not even accepting Torahs from Shemayim. They're wrong. And then we'll get into, and then, so Hasidim would look at the Misnagdim back in the 1700s, and they would say, or the Misnagdim, the Yeshivim would look at the Hasidim and say, what they're doing is not according to halacha, so really it's the same as the Reform. And meanwhile, they're learning, they're davening, and take it until today's day, and within the world of Orthodoxy, we've, as a people, have struggled mightily, and the fallback has often been, if they're different from me, I classify it as not being within the world of halacha, and then I can say it's treif, which is, it's true. If it's not in the world of halacha, then you need to say it's not acceptable. But it becomes very, very difficult, and we historically have not succeeded.
But we have. We're 3,000 years together, and we're still Jews of all kinds.
Correct, but we have not gotten along. Historically speaking, until today, different camps within Orthodoxy, when the world, look at, if the world looks at us and says, are you an Orthodox Jew or a non-Orthodox Jew? So what the world would consider Orthodoxy, within that world, we have a lot of improvements to be able to...
That's the challenge of life. It's been quite a challenge. We're still here as a unit.
Oh, 100%. God has promised we'll always be here.
That's an amazing miracle.
God has promised. Says Rav Hirsch, in other words, I'll even go so far as to say it. Every group within Orthodoxy today would read this and say, I know, of course, within my group there are farmers and doctors and lawyers and scholars and within my group there could be lots of different people. But we haven't been able to figure out that there can actually be all of these different camps. Because everybody, it's been a struggle. It has been a struggle historically, and... that will be when Mashiach will come, we will, or maybe that will bring Mashiach when we're able to figure that out. I'm not sure which way it's going to go. I would say let's figure it out on our own and bring Mashiach. Let's make it happen. Yaakov blesses all of his children in their different class. For the covenant which God established with Abraham wants to win a whole national life, a whole, fresh, complete life of a nation, with its manifold classes and occupations, all of those differences, all for the one and same great task of life, lishmor derech Hashem, to guard the path of Hashem, la'asos, tzako, mishpat, to do righteousness and justice. Their strength and courage, no less than brain and lofty thought and fine feelings, are to have their representatives before God. And all, in the most varied ways of their callings, are to achieve the one great common task of life. It is indeed. And again, the difficulty is interpreting it. Does this mean, as again, within my world, I have very many variations within my world. This one does that, but then as soon as I go outside of that, that's not right, it's not okay. says the first, but just because of that, must each one be brought up al pidarko. And that's why, because Yaakov is going to have these 12 children with 12 different approaches and 12 different elements, each child has to be brought up according to his own way, in that which will bring out that nature, according to the presumed path of life to which his tendencies lead, each one differently to the one great goal. Meaning, the top of the mountain is the goal, everyone's task is to get to the top. How do you get there? There are so many different paths up the mountain. As long as you're climbing the right mountain. If you start heading up the wrong mountain, so we need to say to you, Chavibi, my friends, that's not going to take you to where you need to go. But within this mountain, there can be many paths, and some can take a really long time, some are straight. I like it this way, you like that way. Whatever, just get to the top. You got to get to the top. Says Rafersh, and again, here is his scathing rebuke. Okay. To try to bring up a Yaakov and an Esav in the same college, make them have the same habits and hobbies, want to teach and educate them in the same way for some studious, sedate, meditative life is the surest way to court disaster. A Yaakov will, with ever-increasing zeal and zest, imbibe knowledge from the well of wisdom and court 26 and truth. Yeah, that education for Yaakov, soaking it all up. He just wants it more and more and more. While an Esav can hardly wait for the time when he can throw the old books, but at the same time the whole purpose of life behind his back. A life of which he has only learnt to know from one angle, and in a manner for which he can find no disposition in his whole nature. This is a strong sentence. That what happened was, Esav didn't want to be in the classroom. It was driving him crazy. So when he had the chance to leave, he didn't just leave the books, he left the whole way of life. Because he was taught in a way that didn't work for him. One more paragraph, I'll let you go. But we have to get one more to get to the whole thought here. Had Yitzchak and Rivka, this is why this is such a novel thing that he could say such a thing, because, you know, Ramban and Rashi don't say this. Says the first, had Yitzchak and Rivka studied Esav nature and character early enough and asked themselves, how can even an Esav, how can all the strength and energy and agility and courage that lies slumbering in this child be won over to be used in the service of God? And the future gever, the future man, be trained not to become a man of the field of hunting, but in truth a man of strength before God, then Yaakov and Esav, with their totally different natures, could still have remained twin brothers in spirit and life. And quite early in life, Esav's sword and Yaakov's spirit would have worked hand in hand. And who can say what a different aspect the whole history of the ages might have presented? But as it was, vayigdalu hanarim, they grew up. And only when the boys had grown into men, one was surprised to see that out of one and the same womb, having had exactly the same care, training and schooling, two such contrasting persons emerged. Rav Hirsch is saying, he's saying it's not me. He's saying it's the sages. When the sages said vayigdalu, that they grew, and look, all of a sudden at 13 they became different. That's the sage's veiled way of saying it was a mistake on behalf of Yitzchak and Rivka. So he's not saying this is my comment. He's saying that's how I hear the words of the sages when they point out that the Torah told me the word Vayigdalu, that they grew up, and that nothing was known until they were 13. Nothing was known? You couldn't tell a thing different until then? It's a rebuke. Of course there were differences there. And it was there, you just had to find it. You had to look. And the fact that it wasn't there means that they gave them the same education. They expected them both to be people of sitting in the tents. But Esav, it wasn't for him. And the first opportunity he had, he was out. But instead of just leaving the books, because of what he had received until the point, he just left and said, this isn't for me, obviously. And the knowledge you'll be able to see, some children are going to work with their hands. And they need an education that says, you too can be a major contributor to Jewish life in the fields. Doesn't have to be in the study halls. But if the education that they're given is, you need to learn to be a contributor, then when they leave everything. Because they've been told, if it's not from the books, then you have nothing to offer. until today, we struggle with this. Until today, we struggle with, even forget about other communities outside of Atlanta. Even here, how do we treat our children? They're educated in classrooms, through books and through studying, and it doesn't work for everybody. And it's very hard to be able to then say, we don't have the resources for, you know, so this is how we do it. And the child who's not going to be doing that, to still educate them in a way that says, you have a place, even though it's not here, it's quite a task. And it sure does. It takes strength from the parents and the school to recognize the nature of the child and then be able to provide, with the limited resources that we have, you know, the individualized education that each child needs. Refer to these when the sages say that nobody knew the difference between these two children until 13. That was a rebuke. That was a mistake. And the fact that nobody knew meant that now when they turned 13, it was already too late. Because Asaph had been fed 13 years of an educational system that wasn't right for him, and when the opportunity came, he left it all. Very, very powerful words that refers rights. And he again is saying it's based on the words of the sages. Okay, we'll continue with this verse Hashem next week.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.